We worship a Messiah who suffered. So by my suffering, do I not move closer to heaven? Now, what could be more sanctimonious than that? That's her stance for most of the movies, that she's on this earth to endure the slings and arrows of insulting letters and so on. And yet, Marie, without again spoiling anything, as you say, as the film goes along, and one thing I did like about it was it sets you up that way, and it does actually undercut a lot of those assumptions, and it makes you sort of rethink things a bit. So I wouldn't call it a profound film whatsoever, but it has enough substance that it can sort of take you along that character arc, if you will.
Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show brought to you by Howard Community College, where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Civil War and Wicked Little Letters. And starting with Civil War, Mike, I try never to read anything before I go in, so I kind of thought it was going to be about the Civil War, but it is decidedly not. Without giving away the story, because a lot happens in this movie, how would you set this movie up for our viewers?
I think a great debating point is, what is it really about? What is the subject matter? I have a theory, a notion, rather cynical, that most mainstream Hollywood movies are afraid of genuine political content. I think we occasionally have feature films that are ostensibly political, but you know what? As it plays out, it somehow becomes more generic, or you don't want to lose any voters, as in theater goers, however you want to couch this. And that'd be a more extended discussion. But I think Civil War would be a case in point here. So whether to my credit or discredit, I actually had read a lot about it before I saw it. And so I had preconceived notions, which I would have had anyway. At the very beginning of this film, Civil War, you are led to believe, and it's certainly reinforced in the opening minutes, that with the January 6th insurrection in mind, this is a film that is set in the very near future. It's going to be a little vague and baggy, but that's okay in terms of some of the specifics, but that's the basic ground rule. Because bear in mind, without getting on a soapbox myself, there were people at that rally, if I can call it a rally, who were wearing T-shirts that said MAGA Civil War. So already this is something out and about, certainly in the social media world. But anyway, not getting sidetracked with political tirades of my own here. With that as like an opening notion, within a few minutes, the film had me and then almost completely lost me. And when I say lost me, I don't mean confused. I mean alienated and actually kind of turned off. And I'll tell you why, because if you think about what some likely scenarios might be in the wake of January 6th, and again, I'm not playing partisan politics, am I on this side or that side, but what seems likely, what seems possible? This film was almost immediately ridiculous in that respect. For instance, it is about a civil war. It's about a secessionist movement. But right from the get-go, we're told that, well, who, meaning which states are seceding from the Union? Get this, it's Texas and California. And I thought, huh? Or a reaction to that effect. Uh-huh, what, you know, what's going on here? And in fact, they now refer to themselves, you know, as the Western forces. They have a two-star flag. I mean, it's sufficiently organized that it's not just like a few hotheads saying, hey, let's do this or that. There's an organized thing here, evidently. We don't get any real details there in terms of political organization and voting records and all that, but the heck with that. I mean, the film isn't looking to have that kind of granular look at it, but immediately the premise just fell apart for me because I thought that's so unlikely, so improbable. And so what happens is the film itself actually, even though it has a lot of direct visual references to that two-star flag, it becomes almost meaningless in terms of, you know, who's fighting on which side. And I've heard interviews with the Brit director, Alex Garland, where he, in effect, you know, was defending that kind of more generic treatment. And his line of argument was, you know, and sometimes in a civil war, it gets so messy, after a while, you forget what you're fighting for or what you're fighting against. It's just an all against all kind of chaos. And I can understand that conceptually, but in the film, I think it really falls apart at that level. So the film, I think, fails intellectually, and I think it's very disappointing on that level. I have a mixed response to the film, because even though I think it's a decided failure in that respect, in terms of the actual filmmaking, in terms of the actual staging, it's really visceral. It's really powerful at times. And in effect, it involves several photojournalists from New York who decide to take a road trip, probably not a good idea, from New York to Washington, D.C., in the absurd hope that they could get an interview with the president, who's still trying to hold down the fort, if you will, against the secessionists. I have a lot of reservations and nitpicking in terms of that actual storyline, and we can get into those over the next 3 hours. But what strikes me in the moment is, as I watch it as a film, just simply in a cinematic sense, many sequences are really, really powerful, really well handled. And so that always held my interest and never quite obliterated all those earlier reservations, but gosh, it really was involving to watch this. Now, how about you?
Well, I agree with most of what you said. I kind of thought it was a cop out to not really take a stand in terms of taking one political side or the other. I think that kind of hurts the movie in a way. But I wanted to mention, in terms of this director, in 2022, he described this film that he's making here, the one we're talking about, as a companion piece to his film Men, and said it is set at an indeterminate point in the future, just far enough ahead for me to add a conceit and serves as a sci-fi allegory for our currently polarized predicament. Okay, so, setting that out there, when I thought about the movie Men, I thought that was disquieting in some of the same ways as this movie was. I thought a few scenes that really left you very uncomfortable. But then thinking about his other movies, like, Ex Machina and Annihilation, and is dystopia this guy's hobby horse?
Well, let me add one to that dystopian list. A film for which he was just the screenwriter was 28 Days Later. So he has a sort of post-apocalyptic fixation. And on strictly technical grounds, he's really effective at putting you into that hellish world, if you will. I think it works better in some of the other films you mentioned because you just sort of take those at their face value and they work well for what they are. I mean, if you're going to have, a zombie flick, this is your go-to guy, right? But if you want to have a film with greater pretensions, if you will, this film, I think, is reaching, it's stretching. There are only a few scenes where I think it shows any indication of what it might have been. We'll talk more about the characters and storyline and so on, but it's a deliberately demographic mix of characters. What I mean awkwardly by that is the fact that in the casting, they wanted, we're going to have a white woman, we're going to have, Asian characters, black characters, whatever. That's actually, it's not just a matter of like PC casting whatsoever. It's actually integral to the storyline. And I think it works well in the sense that if you do have a civil war, one side against the other, however you define these sides, playing off of a lot of the controversies that we're living through day to day here, there are hot button issues of race and class, et cetera. So in the casting, it makes perfect sense there. So anyway, there's one scene that I think is really powerful, not just in the staging, but in having genuine political content. Our photojournalists are on the road. Just by chance, they come upon what amounts to a killing field, an execution site. They're not quite sure what they've stumbled on, whose side is this even? And there's a what might be a soldier, several what might be soldiers, or then again, self-appointed militia. We're never quite sure there. And that works really well. It's really creepy. You're like, who are these guys? What do they represent? And the guys have got guns and they're about to use them on our photojournalists. And we've learned earlier in the film that journalists are fair game for, take shots at them. And so it's really a scary scene. But what makes it so effective is the fact that the soldier is kind of staring them down one by one. And he's asking the question, what kind of American are you? And based on their answer, he's going to either shoot them on the spot or let them live. That is such a powerful scene because that crystallizes for me what the rest of the film, in a way, should have been about, as in when people are being defined by race and class, et cetera. That's a kind of civil war right there, even before you get into organized political forces. So, Marie, what's your sense? Because here's a, let me ask you that this then. This is a director who clearly has the technical chops, but I just think at a kind of conceptual slash intellectual level, this thing's not really thought through very well.
I agree, but there are some scenes that are really powerful. Having said that, this is a movie that I found traumatizing in some of the scenes you describe. So it's the kind of movie I'm glad I saw, but I would never watch it again. If it came up on cable, I would never, oh, let me tune in.
Would you
Once
recommend to
is
friends?
enough.
Because we recommend films to our friends. Would you recommend this to our friends who are listening to us right now?
I would not recommend it, and it isn't because it's a bad movie. It doesn't hold together enough in ways that it should. I mean, it's great when it's a movie about, what does it cost a person to become a photojournalist and actually do wartime photography? They get that, they nail that part. You get to see Kirsten Dunst discuss that. She's dealing with a protege of a sort, telling her, how and what to do. But at the moments when it comes up, like, how can you just stand there with that camera? and not help or do something. And she says, "We're recording so others can see." And I thought that really framed things beautifully because you're supposed to be detached. But I mean, that's really pretty impossible, isn't it, Mike?
Well, I would say yes and no in this regard. And I had mixed feelings about the presentation of photojournalists. So the character played by Kirsten Dunst, and she really is terrific. I mean, it's a really strong performance. Her character's name is Lee, and people within that photojournalism world immediately pick up on Lee Miller, who was a famous photographer back in the 40s. And at a time when there were combat photographers in Europe, she was one of the few women with a camera on the front lines that way. When Dachau was liberated, she took really gripping photographs of that. And she really is, a real fascinating figure in terms of cultural history as much as photojournalism. So that kind of referencing is there. And you see the Kirsten Dunst character, Lee, as a kind of modern day or near future equivalent for that. And I like that grounding. Other things, though, at the professional level and at the level of credibility sort of fall apart a bit. For instance, these photojournalists are the character of Lee and a few of the others in the film are said to be working for Reuters, the international news agency. And yet, when you see them photographing out there in the field, the world is falling apart. It's near chaos. We never see them actually like sending the photos out or them being published somehow. I mean, I don't just mean like old-fashioned newsprint, even like online or something. It's like somehow the process get squelched there, and you're not sure. Well, wait a minute, you're taking all these pictures. What's going to happen to them? Will the world see them? And one reason I feel that way is along for the ride is a character named Sammy, played by Stephen McKinley Henderson. That's an actor I'd seen on stage in August Wilson plays, and he's really good. He's an African American journalist, and he works for what's described as what's left of the New York Times. So for even like the most powerful of newspapers is barely holding on. So how are these people getting anything out there, and to what effect? And the fact that even his character, Sammy, he's lived a lot of life, let's put it that way. And he's a humanizing presence in the film and appreciated at that level. But he's not really doing any work that we can see. He's just sort of along for the ride. And I thought, well, is the Times still giving him a paycheck? And how does he receive his paycheck? And you know what I mean? Like I start to nitpick in really mundane ways. And that's where, again, I think the story is undercooked, if I can put it that way. It's just not fully thought through at that level. And then there's this, as you mentioned, a mentoring relationship between Lee and a young woman who wants to be a photojournalist, indeed, Jessie, who actually shoots in black and white because she's sort of old-fashioned in her aesthetic and all. But I thought, well, wait a minute, would publications want black and white photos at this point? And again, how does all this work? And that's where it's more at the matter of what I call scripted convenience. It's essentially a road trip movie. So if you have several people on the road under really dangerous conditions, that demographic mix again makes perfect sense for the aforementioned reasons, but also the fact that as they're on the road, I mean, it works, but by the same token, there's a contrived quality to it. It almost seems like the menu of, we need one of this, one of that, whatever. And so it's justified, but it still seems like to me not entirely plausible in the sense of like who they're working for, how the work gets out there, and so on. And then, as I said at the outset, their journey, if you will, to drive all the way down to DC, they don't have an appointment to meet with the president. They somehow feel they can just drive to Washington, go up to the White House, and knock on the door. And it don't work that way, even under healthy conditions, right? And under these conditions, the White House is quite literally a fortified residence. I mean, really, like high walls around and all. You're not going to knock on the Castle gate and say, "Excuse me, I just drove down from New York. We'd like to talk to the president." That's where it's sort of Looney Tunes, I think, in the scripting. So even though it has that visceral power, intellectually or just at the level of plausibility, I think it's falling apart.
Oddly, I kind of felt like I didn't have a problem with that part. I understand what you're saying about, you want that sort of inside baseball, like is there Wi-Fi? You hardly even see people use cell phones. It seems oddly non-futuristic. But the when you do see what they see through the lens, and you get that sort of snapshot quality. I thought those scenes were very powerful because you're so caught up in the moment. And that's why I thought they weren't uploading things. They were still collecting because they were in this mad dash to get to DC. So I felt like they were just collecting things that would eventually be published.
Well, journalism likes to publish things now and not later as history. So that's a consideration. But also in that respect, the fact that, as they travel along there, really ever since the first Gulf War, the American military actually increasingly has kept photojournalists at a remove from the front lines. They learned to their peril during Vietnam, that became the living room war. One reason being that journalists were still right on the front lines in combat, and all that imagery was coming to American TV screens and newspapers and magazines and so on. And one reason why, and this is again, this is sort of a right-wing interpretation, but when people say, why did we lose or at least have some kind of stalemate in Vietnam? Well, the images that Americans were seeing, they turned against the war because of all that. And the war since then, if you think now about the first Gulf War in particular and conflict since then, when we have an organized military that's moving onto the battlefield, it's increasingly rare to have photojournalists right there on the line. Now, I have to qualify that, but the Civil War we're seeing is anything but conventional, anything but traditional. A lot of things are breaking down. That may well be one of the things breaking down. Now, but these journalists are so much on the front line. Without spoiling the ending at all, by the time the conflict gets to the White House and you have people shooting it out like that, the journalists are right there. I mean, they're right on top of it. And that there are very few wartime situations ever where that would be the case. So that's again where dramatically it works, but at a professional level, it's highly unlikely. Now, under this situation, I'm not going to be the one who steps forward at the White House and say, "Excuse me, but you don't have your badge on you. We don't have clearance to come into this room as we have a shootout." But I'm already like mentally withdrawing from the picture even further.
Well, I want to mention that this is an A24 movie. And, I mention that because people will point out that something is an A24 movie. And I don't think most people talk about production companies or studios anymore. But A24 is kind of known for trying a few daring things. I mean, they had to know not everyone will go see this movie. It's an art house kind of a movie. So, in that way, it's kind of daring. But, Mike, how do you see this in terms of it fitting into A24's, zeitgeist, if I can borrow your favorite word?
Yeah, I bet for the rest of this month, at least, I'm not going to use that word. I've held to it so far, so I won't use the Z word. My favorite art house, the Charles Theater in Baltimore, has a lot of A24 pictures, and so we actually do talk about it that way. And yes, it's a small and edgy company, and they're known for things that sort of push the envelope. So this totally makes sense by way of the kind of film they'd want to represent. And I think enough of the broader public, general public, is starting to become aware of A24 just because they're making a lot of movies, actually. Maybe not huge box office in most cases, but enough movies that people will see one way or another. But this is a tough picture. And again, even with all my reservations, I still kind of admire somebody who wanted to make a movie that would take on this subject matter. I don't think it was done correctly here, if I can put it that way. But, a lot of production companies are so mainstream, they wouldn't want to touch this at all. So, yeah, some props there.
I also want to mention Kaylee Spaney. I thought she was terrific. And I kept thinking, where have I seen her before? Where have I seen her before? And she was in Priscilla
Yeah.
recently.
Yeah,
Yeah,
she
she's
will.
actually done quite a few things. For such a young actor, I thought she really she showed up that day.
Well, the acting carries it as much as the visceral filmmaking. All the principles are really convincing, as performers here. The characters aren't always convincing, but the performers are. That makes a difference. And there's an empathy you have for them. And how can you not be on their side? I mean, ironically, they're neutral, ostensibly, right? They're journalists pursuing the story. But essentially, we are on their side. And I think that keeps us going all through the ride. So, as much as I'm bothered by so many aspects of the film, I cared about these people as people. So, I'm not going to say who gets shot, who lives, who dies, but you really worry about these things because any of them could be shot down at any moment.
Yeah, it's a very tense action picture. And I will say there are a few moments that are witty. Some of it's sort of a sight gag, like the armed force, wearing Hawaiian shirts thing. There are some moments that where I think they really do hit it well, but this is not a movie that's for everybody. But moving on to our second movie, Wicked Little Letters, I think this is a movie for everybody. And I would first describe it as Hawthorne-esque. The whole time I was watching it, I was just thinking Nathaniel Hawthorne would have loved this story. And it's based on a true story about these sort of poison pen letters that start going out in this little town and hilariously creative cussing in them, which is part of the fun, is when they finally read them out loud. It's a guilty little pleasure, which is kind of like Wicked Little Letters. What do you think, Mike?
Well, for Wicked Little Letters, I guess for Nathaniel Hawthorne it would be that Scarlet Letter, but yeah, there is a Hawthorne-esque quality to it that way. I think it's important to couch it this way. This is a period piece. It takes place in a small English village just after World War I, about 1920, give or take, but the war is very recent for these characters, and we'll talk some more about the significance of that. But what strikes me about the premise is that whether rightly or wrongly, when we think about a period piece in general, and a sort of twee or potentially twee comedy of that sort. We have, when I say we, I mean I include myself. We have genteel notions almost of, oh, they're going to be quaint and eccentric, idiosyncratic characters, and they may use the occasional naughty word, but you know, blah blah blah. It's going to be, you know, PG rated, if you will. Well, let me tell you, this film certainly cuts against that, and I think that's the initial appeal of the film, is that it has that kind of village demographic in a, you know, picture postcard England, and yet the moment people start talking, that it's, I'll just say it's rather salty language. And the reason in particular is what Marie mentioned. There are mysterious letters being sent, really vile letters, all kinds of horrible allegations against their fellow villagers, and using the most profane language in such unusual combinations. Like sometimes, like when you're insulted, you wonder, like, well, what was I just called? You know, like I've never used that adjective with that noun before. You know, that kind of a thing, where it's like really weird to contemplate. Now, this is where I had mixed to ultimately kind of negative feelings about the film. Is I think all that's very funny at first, because it not only is that premise amusing and based on fact, as you mentioned, but the fact that, as you would expect in a film like this, there's some really fabulous English actors, the reliables. They always come through. It's always great to see them. So it's a real pleasure to see them. And it's a pleasure to see little old ladies using cuss words. I mean, how else to put it, right? So it's really funny for a while. But my response was, this is a 100-minute long film, which is about the right length. But after about a half hour of it, I thought, okay, it's starting to wear thin. The first few times I see these old ladies, they're not old ladies, but all these villagers sitting around, you know, reading letters aloud in the cuss, I'm laughing too. It's a guilty pleasure. I giggle that way, right? But after about a half hour, I think, okay, I get it, I get it, I get it. And then in terms of, well, who's the source of these profane letters? It's set up as a mystery story. I watched it with an audience where, during our audience discussion afterwards, people were more or less agreeing that, well, the mystery is not such a mystery. Most of us had sort of figured out, you know, who's behind the letters long before the characters did in the film. And that can be a problem with a mystery like this. How dense are you people? Who do you think is writing these letters? And so that sort of spoiled it for me a bit there. So my ultimate feeling, and when I say mixed feelings, I thought it was enjoyable. It was okay. I'm not making great claims for it. And I would recommend it in the sense that, you know, it is something that will have you smiling all the way through and laughing often enough. And we can't say that about Civil War. So there you go.
There you go. Well, I would say, you know, I love Olivia Colman, and she is wonderful in this. She has to play, you know, the uptight, very pious Christian woman who lives next door to this free spirit played by Jessie Buckley. And both of them are great, but they are at opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of decorum and, oh, upbringing, really literally everything. But they're actually kind of similar. And they, I think the movie does a really good job of showing you characters that first seem like stereotypes. And then suddenly you sort of realize when they sort of develop the idea of the two women being friends, that they really are just two different sides of the same coin. That I thought
Well,
was done deftly. And I will also say, watch it just to watch Timothy Spall, who is just odious in this. And without giving away the ending, I will say that at the end, Olivia Colman's character gets to tell him off in a way that is so satisfying. It is worth the price of admission.
the Timothy Spall, and I've loved Timothy Spall as an actor for years, and a lot of people in our discussion have said, well, he really slimmed down. Like, he was always a hefty build, right?
Yes.
And he's so thin. He plays the tyrannical father of the Olivia Colman character. Her name is Edith. He plays the father, and he really is a monster in a
Monster.
paternal sense. Just terrible, but great fun to watch. You wouldn't want him for your father, but he's great fun to watch. And one reason why he's so tyrannical is she is the proverbial spinster, back when people used words like that. And the fact, you know, she's getting these horrible letters, and she's at the middle of all this. She and the Jessie Buckley character, and that character's name is Rose, they form a kind of unlikely and yet almost inevitable, I'll call it a quasi-friendship. They're next door neighbors, but, you know, Edith is, you know, well into middle age. Rose is a young woman. One thing you haven't mentioned that has to be mentioned here by way of differences, by way of ethnicity, the fact that these are all English villagers except for Rose, who's Irish. And the degree of prejudice towards her. So she's suspected immediately of the, she must be the one who wrote these horrible letters, because she's Irish, working class Irish, doesn't speak well, cusses up a storm. She cusses up a storm, so why doesn't she write up a storm of cuss words? You know, it makes sense at that sort of level. She must be the one who's doing this. And what I do like about what you just said is the fact that there are certain assumptions or expectations we have for these two characters based on what I just said. And yet the film is able to undercut some of those or cut through them, as in, well, Rose seems like not just rough around the edges, but just rough. But maybe she has reason to be like this. And, in terms of, someone who's had a really terrible life in a lot of ways and is just trying to survive and get through. And Edith, who's so holier than thou, well, maybe she's not such a goody two shoes and all, because she's so sanctimonious. Like early on, when she's at the heart of all this, and like, well, why is this happening? And she's acting like uptight and prim and proper and offended at these words and so on. She actually, she's asked about this, and here's something she says. She says, is to her sense of being stoical and enduring all this. She says, "We worship a Messiah who suffered. So by my suffering, do I not move closer to heaven?" Now, what could be more sanctimonious than that? That's her stance for most of the movies, that she's on this earth to endure the slings and arrows of insulting letters and so on. And yet, Marie, without again spoiling anything, as you say, as the film goes along, and one thing I did like about it was it sets you up that way, and it does actually undercut a lot of those assumptions, and it makes you sort of rethink things a bit. So I wouldn't call it a profound film whatsoever, but it has enough substance that it can sort of take you along that character arc, if you will. But even that doesn't really entirely satisfy, because although I enjoy the character arc and that evolution, watching it, I'd sort of figured out what the deal was pretty early. And then I just thought the villagers were rather dense and not figuring it out themselves.
Some of the side characters who sort of come to the aid of these ladies as they're going through the situation, I thought were an absolute riot. And I felt like I was watching an episode of Murder, She Wrote. Agatha Christie at any moment is going to step in here. It does a good job of striking that tone. Now, you touched on the idea of the significance of the era, and it kind of, I think you might have been alluding to the fact of Jessie Buckley's Rose character having to try to fit into her new life by telling stories that weren't quite true, which makes you suspect her of not being an honest broker.
Thank you for saying this, because this is right after the First World War. And bear in mind, the Brits had really suffered through that, for 4 long years. And while the men were off fighting, the women were back home taking over many of the jobs and field and factory that the guys had had. Now the guys have come back and reclaimed their jobs. And that's actually something that is talked about in the film. Bear in mind that the suffragette movement is percolating in England too, but it takes longer to percolate there. In the US, American women get the vote in 1920. In the UK, they don't get until 1929. So these issues, again, they're not always foregrounded in the film, but they are mentioned occasionally. I think it's sort of an implied backdrop for this in terms of women being assertive that way. And the Rose character, who's just as a nonstop talker and cusser, and she tells some significant lies in the film, but she might have valid reasons for telling those lies. And again, without spoiling what the lies are and what the truth is, she becomes very sympathetic in that regard. And Edith, it's safe to say, becomes less sympathetic in some respects. And so again, I think that's to the credit of the film. And to pick up on your other point there, as I mentioned at the outset, to use the baseball analogy, they're the deep bench, if you will. There's such great British acting talent. And a lot of those supporting roles are relatively minor characters, but a pleasure every time they're on screen. I think of Eileen Atkins as a character named Mabel. All I have to do is see her, just look at her. Her face will hold your attention, even before she says something. And there are any number of other actors, some of them we know by name, just as others just as well-cast actors. It's that deep bench approach where I enjoy seeing people in a pub or on the street gathering. It's just enjoyable to watch those scenes. And hey, that does a lot more for me than most of the films I see, right? So it's a pleasure just to be in their company.
Agreed, 100%. So that does bring us to the end of this episode. But don't forget to check out our other episodes at atmhcc.podbean.com. And you can also find us on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also watch us on HCC TV and on Howard Community College YouTube page. If you have ideas, suggestions, or comments, you can email us at movies@howardcc.edu or on Dragon Podcast social media, where you can interact with us, give us a like, drop a comment, and share our content with others. And we will see you next time at the movies.
See you then.